You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's a common assumption that positive thinking has the power to bring happiness. This, after all, is the backbone of the self-help industry, a business that thrives by encouraging people to get motivated, make goals, and be optimistic. Oliver Berkman, who writes a weekly column for The Guardian, suggests that the key to happiness may actually be the opposite. In his latest book, The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking, Mr. Berkman looks at how different cultures and philosophies use negative thinking and improve people's lives. His book is published by Faber & Faber, and I'm very pleased to welcome Oliver Berkman to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks very much for having me.
You say the effort to feel happy is precisely what can make someone miserable. What do you mean by that?
I think the idea that I wanted to try to explore in this book is that we maybe have come to significantly overvalue the role of optimism and sort of relentless good cheer in our definitions of happiness. And these ideas that go a long way back in the positive thinking movement about trying to very vigorously sort of make your mind as full as possible of happy thoughts and focusing on the best case scenario, positive visualization, self-help affirmations, all these techniques, and actually suggesting that sometimes they bring about the exact opposite of the effect they're intended to produce.
But are you saying we shouldn't try to be happy? Are you arguing that pessimism is perhaps even more healthy and productive?
I think, you know, I was probably always, as a Brit, going to not be somebody who's on the side of ceaseless smiling. But I don't think that I think the real point that I'm trying to get at is that it's a rebalancing. That actually, yes, there are contexts in which pessimism is the healthy stance to take. There are contexts in which it's optimism. But that this sort of total focus on one side, which goes all the way through the traditions of positive thinking, there's better alternatives to it.
But don't we perform better if we approach a situation thinking positively about it, or should we be sort of thinking negatively about it thinking, you know, I might fail at this, but what the heck, I'm going to try anyway?
It's really interesting, actually, because there's this whole received wisdom in the self-help sector, for example, that you should, if you visualize success running over the finish line or you know, making millions from your new piece of software, that's the way to make that happen. But there's been some fascinating studies. There's some studies out of NYU that in which the subjects were rendered dehydrated. They were then asked to visualize drinking a refreshing glass of water, or some of them were. The ones who did that visualizing were actually had a decrease in their energy levels. They were less motivated to go and achieve that goal.
On the other hand, athletes will tell you that if they visualize jumping over the high hurdles, they usually can do a better job. Boxers visualize doing a number of things to knock out their opponents.
This is fascinating. I've had lots of conversations since I wrote the book specifically on the subject of sports. I think that actually, if you talk to a lot of these people, they're talking about visualizing the golf swing or the next step in the sprint. They're not talking about the finishing line and the adulatory crowds. And I think there's a big difference there. Focus on process rather than outcome.
Well, you traveled to various places around the world to explore different outlooks on life. And you begin with a positive thinking conference in Texas called Get Motivated. Mm-hmm. Do you think that it motivated the people who were there? I mean, they come expecting to be motivated, don't they?
Right. Well, I mean, this was sort of 15,000 people in a basketball stadium on the outskirts of San Antonio. I think they left motivated for a day or two. And, you know, even I was not completely immune to that kind of momentary high. It was kind of a fascinating event. Former President George Bush was one of the speakers at it. But I don't think that lasts. I think that fades very, very swiftly. It's not a sustainable way to go on to achieve things or to feel good.
Did President Bush say that he had used positive thinking when he was in the White House? Did he say that his policies have been based on positive thinking, like nation building in Iraq?
Pretty much. Those weren't the exact words that he used. But what he said was that it was always important as a leader of anything, a country, a state, a school, anything, to be always optimistic that the future was going to be better than the past. So he'd built this kind of circular reasoning, whereby when things went well, that proved he was right to be an optimist. When things went badly, that just showed he needed to be even more of an optimist.
Does the rest of the world see the United States as having an optimistic approach to things?
I think that's true. I think that certainly transatlantically between the UK and the US, there is definitely that stereotype. I was fascinated to be told the other day that these kinds of books, these positive thinking books, never feature in the top 50 bestsellers in France, for example. They've obviously got something very different going on there.
But perhaps it's because the United States is a more successful country these days than Britain and France. I mean, I was thinking about Britain when it thought of itself as ruling the world, or at least the waves. Then things changed when the empire collapsed and the UK went into decline. And I suspect people who might have been optimistic at a certain point, when they saw the world, when things started turning sour, they changed. They lost some of that optimism.
I actually think there's a lot in that. I think these are very much cultural errors. You know, they are things that happen at certain times. They reflect the way in which an economy or a culture is going. I think by that definition, you might want to say that actually the recent financial crises and all sorts of things would warrant a rethinking of this approach in the American context, which is actually the case that Barbara Ehrenreich made as well. Of course, the idea that positive thinking may have contributed to the financial crisis.
Well, it led, some people said, to irrational optimism.
Right, right.
Now, what about the European debt crisis? Wasn't that also based on irrational optimism?
I think absolutely, in some respects. I think that it's really to do with this idea of replacing the irrational optimism with irrational optimism that sometimes involves a pessimism, sometimes involves these ideas that come from ancient Greek and Roman Stoics that involve actually playing out how badly things could go, so that you understand that course of events as well as the upbeat.
Well, are there any countries that are known for having a basically pessimistic outlook?
It's very interesting when you look at the international studies of happiness. There's certainly some debate about how superbly accurate these things are as diagnoses of a national state of mind. But the countries that come out of the top are not the countries that we associate most strongly with optimism. They're sometimes developing countries that have a lot of poverty. There's sometimes countries like Denmark, I know, often comes out at the top. I've heard it fairly persuasively argued that that's to do with having relatively modest expectations.
On the other hand, Germany probably is one of those countries, but for a long time, people believed that the Third Reich would last 1,000 years. So it also depends on what your nation's goals seem to be at any given time.
Right, absolutely. I think there are aspects that go far back in history and culture. There are aspects that can be very easily manipulated by politicians on a sort of year-to-year basis.
My guest is Oliver Berkman, B-U-R-K-E-M-A-N. His book, The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking, is published by Faber and Faber. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later in this hour, we'll speak with Christine Nielsen, David Hyde Pierce, and Sigourney Weaver about their roles in Christopher Durang's latest comedy called Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. You're listening to WNYC, WNYC.org. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC is supported by The Gathering Ireland 2013, a year-long celebration of Irish culture, heritage, music, sport, and fun for those who are Irish or Irish at heart. 2013 is the year when Ireland invites the world to join in the celebration of what is unique and special about Ireland. More information at discoverireland.com. See Think Films, presenting King Kelly, a journey into American internet culture filmed on camera phones, starring Louisa Krause and directed by Andrew Neil. Opens Friday at Cinema Village. More information at kingkellythemovie.com. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide and over 35 years' experience working with global 1,000 companies. More online at oliverwyman.com.
Thank you. We could not have made it through the last few weeks without you. During the unprecedented storm and complicated aftermath, we depended on you for vital information. And as our lives slowly return to normal, we'll continue to need your voices. Because you're more than just listeners. You're invaluable contributors. And you proved once again that we're in this together, all day and every day. WNYC. Never turn it off.
We're back with Oliver Berkman, who is a feature writer for The Guardian, used to be the Manchester Guardian, winner of the Foreign Press Association's Young Journalist of the Year Award, and he has been shortlisted for the Orwell Prize. His latest book, The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking, is published by Faber. Faber, you mentioned Stoicism. One of the outlooks on life that you investigate in this book is Stoicism. And didn't you try your hand at it?
I did. I tried an exercise that is derived somewhat distantly from Stoicism via the great New York psychotherapist Albert Ellis, mm-hmm. who had adapted it in that way. He said that if you had a big problem with embarrassment, for example, you should deliberately embarrass yourself because this would bring your beliefs about how badly things could go into direct encounter with the real experience. And he recommended that you should travel on the New York subway and speak out loud the names of the stations as you approach them. I actually did this in London, which may have been worse given the national approach to self-embarrassment. It wasn't fun. It was a pretty horrifying experience. But
what happened? Did people all just stare at you? Or
a couple of people did. No, this is the real point. I was terrified in advance. When you do it, a few people look up. They think they look at you like you're a bit crazy. But mainly people are wrapped up in their own business, like we all are all the time. And so what you learn from that by actually doing this negative thing instead of desperately trying to avoid it is that there's a big discrepancy between the anxiety that you had in prospect and the reality. It wasn't fun. I don't want to overstate the case, but it was not a sort of catastrophic. I didn't get attacked. I didn't explode. You know.
Well, how does that fit in with this idea that we're talking about happiness for people who can't stand positive thinking? That didn't make you happy, did it?
It certainly cut anxieties down to size. You know, it's certainly a lot easier to do things in public that involve potential embarrassment once you have that awareness. More, I think what it does is it draws attention to one of these key Stoic insights, which is that it is not events in the world that cause distress, but your beliefs about them. And once you've brought that into focus, it becomes much, much more straightforward to sort of manage problematic anxiety, uncertainty, stress, I think.
What about Buddhism? Many people are attracted to it because meditation is often seen as the pursuit of calmness or nirvana and through them, happiness.
I think that you can see meditation and maybe Buddhism as a whole as almost the opposite of positive thinking.
Negative thinking?
I would say it's about learning to resist the urge to always be needing to try to think positively. I did a week-long silent meditation retreat while reporting the book.
And in Massachusetts, yes. Not in an ashram in India.
No, it was in Massachusetts. It was still...
Or not in Kathmandu.
No. It's difficult enough even in Massachusetts, I have to say. What you're training to do there, as I understand it, is to be present with whatever arises in your inner experience. I think that's very clearly the opposite of always trying to manipulate your inner experience in the direction of being really happy and upbeat.
You spent a week meditating in silence.
In silence, yeah.
Did that teach you anything?
Well, the first thing it teaches you is that when you remove all the outer noises, there you just realize how incredibly noisy it is inside all the time. For the first day and a half or something, I just had really annoying pop songs going around in my head. It wasn't illuminating at all. Then you get stressful thoughts and self-berating thoughts and all the rest of it. But you gradually learn to realize that the point is not to try and get rid of them. And then, of course, they do tend to dissipate of their own accord.
So which one was more effective for you, meditation or Stoicism?
Well, if you look at what I've adapted and integrated into my day-to-day life, I do try to keep up a meditation practice. I do not go onto the subway and say things to embarrass myself on a daily basis. On the other hand, I do ask, you know, the question, what's the absolute worst that could happen here? Probably every day. It's a very useful little intervention to get rid of anxiety, I think.
You traveled to a Nairobi slum to understand how security and wealth affect happiness. What did you find?
What I wanted to do here was to confront this really quite awkward truth that people in situations of very great poverty and general fragility of their circumstances actually often in both surveys and anecdotally seem to be either happier than people in with great security, or at least not as unhappy as you might expect. It's a very strange thing, and it's lots of problematic implications. Like you could take that as meaning that we shouldn't help alleviate poverty and disease, and I don't think that at all. But what you discover is that when people don't have the option of falsely looking for security in the next promotion or a next bigger apartment, they are thrown back onto resources that I think lead more sustainably to well-being.
Wasn't Nigeria found to be the happiest nation in the world? I thought about that. Nigeria, which has been the scene of ethnic, religious, and economic strife pretty much since independence when Biafra was seceded. Now there is a rebellion. There are people who are killing each other in the oil-producing areas, and in the north, Muslims and Christians are engaged in a semi-civil war. This is the happiest country in the world?
Well, there was one finding, and I don't recall whether Nigeria was first or second in that of the country studied, but it certainly did rank very high. I don't think any of this entails trying to believe that those afflictions happening to a country are anything but a terrible thing, but there is a certain benefit that comes from having no option but to face those realities.
Well, maybe they're just optimistic that those internet scams that come out of Nigeria will succeed. Often when people try to achieve a desired outcome, they set goals for themselves or for a business. Is that a productive approach to improvement?
One of the things I look at is this concept of the over-pursuit of goals, the idea that a goal can become so fundamentally a part of your personality or of your company that you will pursue it way beyond the point at which it makes sense to do so. And there is some fascinating evidence, everything from mountaineering disasters through to what went wrong with General Motors, large numbers of examples that all have this thing in common, that you pick out a target, you focus everything on it, and it causes all sorts of problems.
So what should you do instead of setting a goal? A New Year's resolution is a bad idea?
Well, I tend to think New Year's resolutions are an especially bad idea because it's, well, firstly, New Year's Day, if you've been out the night before, is the worst day possible to try to assert your willpower and self-discipline. I think the real best alternative, and this emerges not just from my experience and from sort of anecdote, but from studies of successful entrepreneurs, is that actually if you can learn to be more comfortable with the lack of direction, with the uncertainty, to act anyway in the context of not knowing exactly where you're going, you'll actually be open to far more fruitful opportunities in the long run.
You took a trip to a museum of failed products outside of Ann Arbor, Michigan. Well, Michigan is, of course, the right place for that. Did you learn anything about success there?
Yeah, they don't like the name Museum of Failed Products. I have to stress it's what they've become known as in the industry. This is a collection of consumer products that didn't start as being failures, that the owner just decided to collect every new product that was launched. But, of course, most do fail, and the result is you get this extraordinary storehouse of things that have gone wrong, of microwavable scrambled egg in tubes that you're supposed to eat in the car, and shampoo that's made of yogurt, and all these things that just don't work. And there's an enormous amount of learning, I think arguably much more to be learned from those than from the ones that succeed.
Well, in those cases, the biggest problem is that people put a lot of money and effort into them and they lost everything.
Well, on a personal level, for the designers and the manufacturers, I think that's a real thing. Then what happens, of course, is that nobody in those companies wants to confront this record of failure. So they brush it and they put it in the cupboard. And then they make the same mistakes again because there's a kind of allergy, I think, to confronting it.
Well, you say J.K. Rowling has a sophisticated view of failure.
She gave a fantastic graduation speech in which she spoke about failure having been liberating for her. It's always a risk with famous, very successful people that they're really just saying that in hindsight. But I think she really did find meaning and direction from being able to have failed first.
Well, she failed, and then she had this huge success. And then the reviews to her new novel have been pretty awful. So I wonder if failure after you have had that kind of success is the same as failure before you've had success.
That's a fascinating question. I have no idea, but it's a very interesting to speculate.
Your final tool in finding happiness is confronting death. Do you mean our own deaths or the deaths of others?
I mean primarily in the context of this book, our own mortality. I think that to some extent, it's impossible to avoid confronting the deaths of others. But as many people have observed, it's possible to go for years of your life acting as if it's never going to happen to you.
Yeah, people have said it's almost impossible to imagine your own death.
Right. That was Freud's big point, I think, that you actually couldn't go through the mental exercise that would be required to know what it was like.
Do you think that the way the Mexicans deal with death, the day of death and all of that, that skeletal imagery is a good way of dealing with it?
From what I could tell, yes. I found it completely fascinating the time I spent in Mexico. It's not a question of saying, oh, death is a good thing. It's a question of saying, of just normalizing it, of just bringing it into a daily conversation or an annual festival, of just sort of hanging out with this fact, you know. And this, I think, is in the whole tradition of memento mori, and that in various places is being rediscovered. I think it's just a very healthy thing.
Yeah. Well, do you think that it has an impact on the level of happiness in Mexico?
Well, Mexico certainly performs extraordinarily well in those international surveys that I was
despite
I was
all of its
about.
Problems.
Absolutely,
I'm beginning to think that the more problems a country has, the happier it is.
Well, I think if you look at those charts and you look right down at the bottom, you'll find some very, very troubled places as well. I think it is absolutely the combination of what happens and the attitude that you manage as a culture to take towards what happens.
Well, now I don't know whether happiness has diminished a bit with all this talk about a fiscal cliff in this country. Or do you think that people are basically optimistic that no matter what Congress does and what the White House does, everything's going to turn out okay because we're Americans?
Well, if that is part of the conversation, I think it is not a useful way to approach an impending crisis. I mean, actually, to be able to see the other side of it, to understand what you might do to go on if it all went terribly wrong, I think is a far more durable kind of attitude to go into things like that. The idea that it absolutely must work out for the best is very sort of fragile and brittle approach, I think.
It was pointed out when people like Norman Cousins were arguing that one way of fighting cancer and those kinds of illnesses was to think positively, actually caused trouble for people in whom the cancer reoccurred because they felt that they just hadn't done the job correctly.
Right. I think
they felt guilt.
Yeah, there is a huge problem with the ideology of positive thinking, that if anything goes wrong, it's because you weren't thinking positively enough. And I think this has ramifications both in those kind of the approach to illness, the approach to poverty. There are self-help books called things like, you know, you're poor because you want to be, which I don't think is a helpful attitude to take to alleviating that problem. I think it's quite deep in the logic of positive thinking, yeah, that it seems to justify in a way or to make personal and blameworthy all sorts of things that happen to people through no fault of their own.
One of our listeners, Amy from Manhattan, has written in that the advantage of pessimism is that either you get to be right or you get to be pleasantly surprised. Is that what you mean by negative thinking?
It's definitely part of it. I think this is a whole family of approaches. It's not just pessimism. It's not just confronting failure or death, but that is absolutely one of them. I think it's a tremendous way to think about things.
Your previous book was called Help: How to Become Slightly Happier and Get a Bit More Done. Did that have a similar approach, or have your attitudes changed?
I think they've evolved somewhat, but that was a collection of my columns from the Guardian, that earlier book. And what I was trying to embody in that title was just the idea that, you know, even if we are going to think about things positively, there is so much benefit in this idea of incremental positivity, of rejecting these ideas of all or nothing that just never, ever end up working out, that you've got to change your life completely in every way right now, that sort of stuff.
What kind of response you get from your readers in The Guardian to this message?
Generally, I find that it strikes a very strong chord, that people, not so much people telling me, thank you for telling us this great wisdom, but people telling me that's what I've been saying for years, you know. It's possible that there are positive thinkers who object to it, but I think that they probably won't criticize me as much because then they'd have to be negative, and it would go against their own personal philosophies.
Well, how much would this also be a reflection of the politics of a country at any given time? I would think that pre-Thatcher Britain would have a different attitude about these sorts of things than post-Thatcher England.
I think self-help is something that goes along with individualist phases in social history, definitely.
Well, do self-help books sell well in England or only in this country?
No, they sell pretty well in England too. And the whole of the UK. I think it's something that there are definite cultural differences, but there are fewer between Britain and America than you might think.
Although you point out that they don't do well in France, and that's because the French think that they already know everything.
I would be speculating.
Would it be a mistake to be optimistic about the messages that your book holds?
I really think this is about yin and yang. It's about balance. It's about seeing that you can, that we need the whole of the human emotional repertoire, not just one half of it, and then we try and pretend the other half doesn't exist.
Oliver Berkman's book, The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking, is published by Faber & Faber. Meanwhile, we can probably read your articles online from The Guardian.
Yeah, that's true.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.